Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and the chair of this program. It is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Nina Shapiro. Dr. Nina L. Shapiro is one of America's leading physicians. With more than two decades of experience in clinical and academic medicine, she's a trusted expert whom her patients and the media rely on routinely to set the record straight about the latest health fads and misconceptions. Her trademark wisdom, engaging personality, and no-nonsense attitude will be accessible to readers everywhere in a new myth-busting and evidence-driven book published by St. Martin's Press in May 2018 and for sale in the lobby after the program. Dr. Shapiro is the Director of Pediatric Otolaryngology and Professor of Head and Neck Surgery at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and has received numerous prestigious awards throughout her career. A graduate of Harvard Medical School and Cornell University, she completed her surgical residency at Harvard and finished additional subspecialty training in pediatric otolaryngology at the Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children in London and the Children's Hospital of San Diego. She is the go-to physician in Los Angeles and around the world, as many international patients seek her out for treatment of challenging cases that can't be resolved in their own countries. Producers and journalists have Dr. Shapiro on speed dial when there's a controversial health study or a medical story in the news, and she's appeared on many broadcast programs, including CBS's The Early Show, Extra, CNN, and National Public Radio. She is a regular guest on Emmy Award-winning television show The Doctors, and her work has been featured and published in The Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, Hollywood Reporter, Red Book, Prevention, First for Women, Real Simple, and other print and online publications. Dr. Shapiro is a seasoned and dynamic public speaker who has presented to thousands of academics, physicians, and general counselors, consumers across the country. A skilled writer with a knack for communicating about health topics in a straightforward and compelling style, Dr. Shapiro is a prolific blogger and a major contributor to academic publications with more than 80 peer-reviewed publications and more than 200 national and international scientific presentations to her credit. She is also a regular contributor to the award-winning educational website, kidsinthehouse.com, where she's featured in numerous videos on health-related topics, from air purifiers to sleep apnea. Without further ado, Dr. Shapiro.
Well, thank you so much for that kind invitation, and I'm really happy to be here. Thank you all for coming out tonight. This is an exciting trip for me. I'm just coming from down the coast a little bit in Los Angeles. It's a little bit chilly up here, but it's absolutely beautiful. So thank you for having me. So I thought I would start out, I know we'll have questions at the end, but I thought I would start out by asking you some questions. First of all, just with a show of hands, who here takes a daily vitamin or supplement? Raise your hands. Oh, goodness gracious. More than one. Keep your hands up. More than one. More than two. More than three. Four. Five? Okay. All right. So we have a little work to do, but we're not in too bad a shape here. Who in this room had a flu shot last year? Year before? Year before? Oh, wow. This is a good crowd. Year before? Year before? Okay. So we've got some pretty healthy people here. Some of us here are physicians in the audience, and we actually, for the most part, cannot go to work without a flu shot during the flu season, unless we wear a mask for 6 months, which is a little bit uncomfortable when we're talking to little children. It's terrifying to them. So most of us do get a flu shot. Who here has ever, and this is, you know, nobody sees you in the audience on film. Who here has ever texted and driven? Oh, come on, come on. Pretty good, pretty good. So a couple things. Who here always wears a seatbelt? Of course, okay, done. For those of us who ride bicycles or scooters or those dangerous birds that they have here and they also have in Los Angeles, who always wears a helmet when you're on something with wheels? Okay, pretty good. So we've actually got a pretty healthy crowd here, a couple little spots here and there, but other than that, we're pretty good. But, you know, part of the inspiration, really one of the biggest inspirations for my writing this book, Hype, is that so many smart people, like us, we're all in this room, we're all smart people, we are fed so much information on a minute-to-minute, second-to-second basis. We don't even realize how much new information we're getting all the time, all day, the clicks on our phones, the internet is obviously one of the biggest, that it is overwhelming, and not just for patients and for people not in healthcare, but for doctors as well. And I am a doctor, and my husband is a doctor. We're surrounded by medicine, but even we get duped all the time, or we get this information that we don't really know. Is it true? Is it something that we just heard or we misheard? We get lured in by scare tactics or something that just sounds really good. And I thought it was really important for me to dig a little bit deeper to find out a little bit about what's going on in the health sphere and how to really be able as a health consumer to digest all of this information that's coming to us so quickly. So how do we all get our information as quickly as possible? Like it or not, whatever sort of level of tech savvy you are, we get our information, including our health information, from the internet. It comes quickly. Even if we're not looking for it, it comes at us. And this is overwhelming, but that's the nature of how we get things, whether it's news, whether it is a great new piece of health information, a great new piece of academic information, gossip, whatever we get, internet is really our main source of very rapid information. What is the main search engine that we use? It's located close to here, and that is Google. Google is the largest internet source that most people have, and it's also the source that most people use. When we look something up, we use Google for the most part. Now, 2006 was a big year for Google. Anybody know why? 2006 was a very big year for Google because that's the year that Google became a verb, and you can Google that. So that sort of brought it to a different level. It's not just an entity. It's not just a place. It is actually something that people do. It is an activity. You Google something. So now Google has become a verb, and we really use it for so many pieces of information. One of the inspirations, and I talk about this in the book, is a friend of mine was panicked one night, and he didn't want to bother his doctor, so of course he would email me, that his child had an unusual poop. Well, I am an ENT doctor, and I have children that are a little bit older, so I don't really think about this, but he was concerned. So he Googled it, and he found all of these, either she's dying, and she needs to be rushed to the hospital, or she's fine, and nothing's wrong, and nothing in between. And that's the problem with Google, although it does give you so much information so quickly, it is overwhelming. A young child had some pain in his left arm because he was playing basketball and swimming too frequently. He Googled left arm pain, and one of the things that comes up is he's having a heart attack. So it's true. You can be having a heart attack if you have left arm pain, but it's certainly not something that you should be thinking about. So you know, it is important to use Google, and it is an excellent source, but a lot of what you need to do is figure out what you're looking at. And as a savvy health consumer, as a person who's going to have medical issues or medical questions, or your family's going to have medical questions, how do you do a Google search? Because it is such a good source. So one of the most common things that is seen in women, 1 in 8 women in their lifetime will have breast cancer. So if you Google, if you just put in the words, the search engine breast cancer, under a second, you will get 110 million sites about breast cancer, more than enough to keep you busy. But how do you know which are the good sites? Is it the first page? Is it the last page of Google? If you look at a first page of a Google search, it's very nicely crafted. You'll see the top few sites are going to have that little green box that says ads, and the bottom is going to say ad. It doesn't mean that it's false. It doesn't mean that it's wrong, but it is an advertisement. Somebody is paying for you to click onto that site, and that's usually for the first few pages of every Google search that you do. Ads on the top, ads on the bottom. It will draw your eye in. It's very enticing. And what gets trickier is if you Google something and you don't even realize that you're going to bias your search. So what does that mean? You could say best breast cancer treatment, or worst breast cancer diagnosis, or best breast surgeon put in your city. is that really going to give you the information that you're looking for, or is it going to give you something that somebody's paying for? More likely than not, it's going to be giving you something that somebody's paying for. Again, it doesn't mean it's wrong. It doesn't mean it's bad, but it does mean it's biased. And you just need to remember that when you look at something and when you read anything, especially if it's online. It's going to have some bias if there's an advertisement hooked to it. So then a lot of people say to me, well, you know, how do you know what's a good site? You know, you're saying that this is all biased or it's all nonsense. How do you really know? Well, you know, in general, the more boring the site and the more just pure information, probably the more valid it is. If it's a large statistical analysis, meta-analysis with hundreds of thousands of patients over multiple decades, and it's just going to have a little bit of information that you can sort of tease out, that's actually probably going to be pretty important and valid, as opposed to something that's going to have some flashy, colorful results and pharmaceutical buzzwords and things like that. So just be careful when you're looking for things. In general, the .gov sites have statistical information, the CDC or any of the academy sites. For instance, our academy, which is a very small field, the American Academy of Otolaryngology, has information for patients. And it's purely information. We are not selling anything. We are just giving you information. You have ear pain, you can learn about it that way, as opposed to going to a site that's going to take you to a medication that they're selling you for ear pain. So Google is very quick, and obviously any of the internet information that we have is so quick. And, you know, again, under a second, 110 million sites. We don't need that many that much information that quickly. But we get it, and it comes in the orders of hundreds of millions, tens of millions. And it gets to millions of people at one time. It doesn't mean that we're being tricked and it's, you know, we're not, you know, the idea of us and them and it's malicious and everybody's out to get us. And this is nothing new. You know, the idea of having a little hoax or a little bit of a trick is hundreds of years old, decades old, centuries old. Some of you may or may not have heard of Clark Stanley, who lived a little over a century ago. And Clark Stanley was a gentleman who had a potion that he made. It's about this big, a little vial, and he said, this potion I have is made with a little bit of rattlesnake venom, and this will cure your ails. It will help arthritis, heart pain, diabetes, you name it, wellness. It's going to promote longevity, all the buzzwords that we're talking about now, except this was over a century ago. And he would go town to town, and for 50 cents, which was now about $13, not so bad, you can buy this little vial, and it would be the secret to longevity. Well, some federal agents got a hold of this, and they decided to see what is in this magic rattlesnake venom that he's claiming. What are really the ingredients? Turns out it was a little bit of mineral oil, some beef fat, and some Tabasco sauce to give it that little medicinal taste. So Clark Stanley was the first snake oil salesman, and that's how the term snake oil came to be, was this little fake venom. Again, he got thousands of people over a long period of time. Most of us have heard of P.T. Barnum. We don't have to tell you who he was. And, you know, a lot of us have seen that great movie, and we all know about Barnum and Bailey Circus, which closed after about 150 years. It closed a few years ago. Most of us know that P.T. Barnum was a hoaxer, and he was, abused animals and abused a lot of workers as well. But this was well before the time of the circus that he was a hoaxer. And he would, before he had the circus, he would claim that he had the answer to seeing the most beautiful mermaid. And you can come for just a few cents at the time, see the Fiji mermaid. And you would come and pay a little money and see this Fiji mermaid, which was really just an ape skull sewn to a fish's body. It was actually pretty disgusting if you see the old pictures of it. But people fell for it. Thousands of people fell for this. He would also claim that I have this elderly woman. She's actually 161 years old. She was George Washington's nurse, and you can come listen to her, and she will tell you tales of our dearly departed first president. And people fell for this. Thousands of people fell for this. Now, us, we're all smart. We know everything. We can't get fooled. We look back at this and say, wow, people are so gullible back in the early 20th century. How can they fall for this stuff? Well, in 2014, during the Sochi Olympics, there was a YouTube video of a feral wild wolf that snuck into the U.S. athlete's dormitory. This video went viral within a matter of hours, and people were terrified. Oh my goodness, there's this wild wolf in the U.S. dormitories. What's going on? And mainstream media fell for it. Today Show, you name it, it was posted all over. 5 million people fell for it in a matter of hours until it was found out that this was also a complete hoax. This was a rescue animal. Nobody was harmed. It was done in a Hollywood studio. Jimmy Kimmel put it on his show the following night, and it was completely fake. So we look back and we see these thousands of people that would pay 50 cents for nothing. But here we are in this decade, in this millennium, falling for stuff even more quickly than they fell for centuries ago. So it's really, it's you know, unfortunately, there's nothing new under the sun. And we, you know, we keep falling for this stuff over and over again. Another thing I just need to mention about the internet, it's not yet a verb, but it might be, and that is Yelp. Although it can be. You can say, don't Yelp your doctor, which I always say, don't Yelp your doctor. But Yelp is a great site. And for those of you who are not familiar with it, it is a review site, and it reviews things like restaurants. You can review your hotel. The hotel we're staying, hopefully has great Yelp reviews. Where we had dinner last night, hopefully has great Yelp reviews. Nobody got sick. But you know, when it comes to Yelping something in healthcare, it's a little bit grayer. So there are about 100 million people who go to Yelp every month. So some of you are probably using Yelp for something. But when it comes to healthcare, whether it's a hospital or your doctor or a clinic or a health system, it gets very tricky. Because if you read a lot of Yelp reviews, and I read them because they're interesting, it's a lot about experience. What did you think about it? Was the service a certain way? Was the food tasting a certain way? Was the quality a certain way of the sheets in the hotel room? But when it comes to your health care, it's really hard to put that sort of quality, certainly in a little review. You know, we get reviews in our hospital from patients, and, you know, it's usually such a small number of patients that it really doesn't have any statistical value. It's just interesting to read. But a lot of it, if you read it, is based on the experience. I couldn't find parking. I was late for the appointment, and they made me wait another hour. And this person was not nice, and I waited in the exam room. And a little bit about the doctor, and maybe the doctor was good or bad, but what you're really thinking about is your experience and also the outcome. So if your doctor completely missed what you had and missed the boat and missed the diagnosis, but you ended up very healthy, you may give that doctor a very good Yelp review. But if you had a horrible illness that was incurable, you may say you had a terrible doctor or a terrible hospital that has nothing to do with the actual care. So just, you know, when it comes to healthcare especially, it's much more complicated than just an experience. It is a gray zone, and there's so much more involved and so much more emotion involved when we're talking about our health or our family's health. So just, you know, we're really trying as doctors, I think, to remove any sort of medical care, certainly individual doctors on Yelp, because it's really hard to know what people are basing the experience on. It's not necessarily an actual outcome or a good or a bad result. So a lot of people say, okay, so you're talking about the internet and you're saying that don't Google this and don't Google that, and how do we know what's good? You know, where are the good websites? Because we all use the internet. It's such a valuable source. So, you know, one thing to just keep in mind is that I'm a doctor. I'm not trying to be a celebrity. So that should also go for celebrities. They are not doctors, so they shouldn't try to be doctors. So if you don't want to get acting advice from me, and you shouldn't, clearly, I don't know what I'm doing, you shouldn't get health advice from a celebrity. They look beautiful. They seem beautiful. They have lovely lives, but they are not doctors. And then there's that sort of gray zone of doctors who are celebrity doctors. And, you know, that's walking a little bit of a fine line, and many of you know that some of the doctors have sort of crossed that line into celebrityhood and not necessarily giving sound health advice. So, you know, just keep, that's a very basic thing to keep in mind, that, you know, what does this person do when they're not online? Are they actually a doctor? Are they actually a celebrity or somewhere in between? You know, there are lots of good sites, and a lot of people have said to me, well, I'm not in medicine. I don't have access to these sites. I can't see these studies. And that's actually not the case. So an offshoot of Google is Google Scholar, and it's actually scholar.google.edu or .com. And it's an excellent site because it's purely the article. So if you read an article in a newspaper or online and you can't find the source that they are mentioning, then it's probably not accurate or not a good a good piece of information. And you should be able to find that site, that source, the article, pretty easily on Google Scholar. You may not be able to get the whole article if you're not a subscriber or if you're not at a larger institution, but you can at least see the abstract, which really gives you the main points of an article. You can see the methods, the results. You can see whether it was 10 patients or 10,000 patients, whether it was over a six-month period, over a 60-year period. So it does give you a lot of information. And the same goes for PubMed, which is a pure academic research site that can show you all of the articles on a given topic, and you can look it up yourself. And again, you may not be able to see the entire articles. You may have to pay for the articles if you're not a subscriber, but you can see the abstracts for free. And that information is pure. It's not very interesting. Medical writing is very boring. And I actually just gave a talk to our residents about medical writing for the non-medical audience, because people who write medical articles, we don't even realize it, but we're writing in the passive voice. It's a very strange way of writing and communicating. And so when you read these articles, it sounds a little bit strange and a little bit stilted. And I think that's just the way doctors like to communicate. We have funny ways of speaking. So, you know, what are the other sources? So outside of the internet, we obviously hopefully don't live completely on our phones or at our laptops or online, although that is the quickest way. We also get information from articles from the newspaper. For those of us who still like to get paper, I like to get paper to hold every day in the morning. I don't read the newspaper on my phone. Radio, for those of us who still enjoy radio, and television. There's still lots of different ways that we get information, but it really goes the same for all of these pieces of information. It may not be quick. For instance, most newspaper articles, you can find them online 3 days before they actually hit your front door, but it's nice to actually read the full articles in the paper. But really, it's the same thing that goes. When you're reading an article, and I'll say it again, people oftentimes, especially if they're reading something that's not in their area or not in their profession, they don't give themselves enough credit to be skeptical. And if you read something that sounds so amazing and too good to be true, think about it. Think about, how could this really be? Could this be too good to be true or too bad to be true? Again, most headlines are usually too bad to be true. And just step back and think about it and do a little research yourself. Look up the article that they're quoting. See what really they were talking about. Newspapers need to fill their papers. They need to get articles out there. So sometimes, you know, there's a little bit of exaggeration, to say the least. And I always mention these buzzwords that we hear, whether it's in the newspaper or on products. Clinically proven. What does that mean? It means nothing. It's a marketing term. Doctors recommend. Okay, so I'm a doctor. There are a few doctors in the audience. We could all recommend that you have, you know, sugary cereal every morning. So then we can put on that sugary cereal, doctors recommend this sugary cereal. So doctors recommend really doesn't mean anything. We know about the famous gum. 4 out of 5 dentists recommend this brand of gum for patients who chew gum. Well, who are these dentists? And what does the other dentist recommend? And was it really 4 dentists, or was it 40,000 out of 50,000 dentists? It's pure marketing. It's brilliant. It works, but we all fall for it, and, you know, doctors included. So when you see these buzzwords, really think twice. Again, nothing is really so great that it really deserves this, and it really doesn't have any meaning in a scientific or research standpoint. And the same things when you go to the grocery store, which is really quite overwhelming these days. You know, we have the peripheral aisles where there's the organic food, and then there's the horrible conventionally grown food, which, but besides that, you know, if you're just looking at packaged foods, it's interesting and entertaining, but it really, you know, is a little bit overwhelming. If you see something like whole grain goodness, what does that mean? Or, you know, some of them actually have meaning, but the meaning is so kind of smaller than you would think. So, for instance, if something says excellent source of, so that's actually a true term that has to be valued. So excellent source of means that product has to contain 20% or more of the daily value of whatever they're saying it's the excellent source of. Good source of, it only has to have 10%. And source of, it just has to have it in it, one drop. So, you know, if you see this juice drink and it says source of juice, it probably has a drop of real juice or with real juice or contains real juice. It usually has extremely little that has no actual value in what you're buying. It's interesting, but again, it's overwhelming. And then it's the other extreme. So this is all the stuff that's good. And then what are the and then they take out all the bad stuff. So low in sugar, low in fat, high in this, no GMOs, no added sugar to some sugary juice drink that already has 30 grams of sugar. How could they possibly add more sugar to the sugar drink? So it's, you know, you just need to be, and I'm not saying you shouldn't buy any of these foods. I'm just saying you need to be skeptical and really just think about what you're reading and what they're saying, because often it's purely marketing. And probably the biggest marketing food product that we see is superfood. So superfood, well, you know, this is a superfood. So I grew up in the 70s, and when I was growing up, pasta was a superfood. And no, it was no longer spaghetti. That was sort of, you know, for the different people, but the pasta people was all of a sudden a superfood. Frozen yogurt was a superfood. And, you know, these are carbs and basically ice cream. And, you know, bran muffins were a superfood, which is 500, 600 calories of sugar and fat. They taste great. And superfoods evolve. And that's purely, again, it's purely a marketing term. There is no actual nutritional definition of a superfood. Nowadays, the harder it is to pronounce, the better it is for you. So acai, which is not acai, is a superfood because it has antioxidants, and turmeric and curcumin and quinoa. I finally learned how to say that. These are all supposed superfoods. They're good for you. I'm not saying they're not good for you, but they're not magic. They're not going to cure cancer. They're not going to prevent cancer, and they're not going to treat your cancer. They're certainly good for you, and they do have some things that can reduce your risk for cancer. And they're certainly, if you do have cancer or a chronic illness, it's good to have a healthy diet and eat these foods that are good for you. But they will not cure you of anything. And you know, I think certainly on this coast and probably on the East Coast as well, people have really gotten lured into these ideas of natural treatment, which is certainly good, but it should not take the place of conventional treatment, certainly when it comes to chronic illness. So, you know, these are some of the good things that sort of pull us in, and it gets us to buy the food or get the juice drink. And that's another thing about juice drinks. All of these superfoods, you know, especially the berries, when you juice them down and people say, oh, well, this contains, you know, I'm going to drink this 8-ounce drink, which contains 6 pounds of kale. First of all, you don't need to eat 6 pounds of kale, but the most important benefit of something like kale or berries is the fiber. And when you juice it down, you take out the fiber, you add more sugar just because you're removing the fiber from it. You're not adding sugar, but it's just concentrated sugar. So the juicing down of all this stuff is actually a negative. And again, more is not necessarily better when it comes to a lot of these foods. So those are the good things. But what about the bad headlines? Because most of the headlines that we read are bad. I mean, frankly, you know, the newspaper, it's rarely good news, usually on the last page. But, you know, the bad headlines are really terrifying, and they work. They really scare us. Cell phones cause cancer. Cell phones cause brain cancer. And this was a big debate a few years ago. You know, really, the neurosurgeons, brain surgeons were worried about this. And there were some brain surgeons are saying, I'm not using my cell phone anymore, you know, without a Bluetooth or only on speaker, because I think it can contribute to the risk of brain cancer. Neurologists were worried as well. They're still looking at this. You know, brain cancer is very rare. Cell phones are very common. It's really hard to study these things. And, you know, for all of these scares, it's really hard to define cause and effect. Association gets a little bit gray, but when it's cause and effect, it's really hard to tell. Artificial turf causes cancer. That was another big headline a few years back when there was a cluster of lymphomas in athletes who were exposed to high levels of artificial turf because of some of the contents may be carcinogenic in very high concentrations. Lymphoma is the most common cancer in teenagers, and artificial turf exposure is also very common. So it's really hard to necessarily say what's cause and effect and what's just an association or a cluster. Vaccines and autism have also been a big controversial area. You know, do vaccines cause autism? Is an association? Can it trigger certain things in certain patients? Or, you know, is it just really incidental? Obviously, there are millions and millions of children who've gotten vaccines, and autism is on the rise. Is there an association, or is it true and unrelated? It's still being looked at. There was a study that just came out last week looking at pregnant women getting the pertussis immunization, which is important because it protects the baby, looking at their babies later on. So they're not even born yet, and getting the vaccine through the mother, is that going to put them at risk to autism? And the findings were that it isn't. So, you know, and then obviously in this town, you know, the big news is does glyphosate cause cancer? And were people hiding something about that Roundup? So, you know, this has been in the news just in the last week or so, you know, and just taking apart whether something is hidden or are there emails or people are trying to sequester information. I think what's most important is what is the answer? Does it or doesn't it? And does it, if, you know, in what concentration and what level? So then we could move on and figure out whether this is safe or not. So, you know, it's very difficult. And again, we get pulled in by these headlines so easily when we hear something and then we say, oh, I'm not going to do that anymore. Oh, wait, no, I'm going to do that anymore. And this comes for so many things. I'm going to hold my cell phone. I'm not going to hold my cell phone. I'm, you know, my son's holding my cell phone. So, you know, what's the risk? I think the most important risk we know for something like cell phones is that don't text and drive. And, you know, and certainly for the young population, the 12 to 20-year-olds, you know, don't be nasty on your cell phone. I think that's much more dangerous as far as nasty texts and shaming and bullying online and on media. So I think that's a known thing about cell phones. But as far as whether putting it on your ear or leaving on your lap, if that's going to cause cancer, you know, that's still a very gray area. And we have so many of these gray areas. But the problem is when we look online or we get a headline, it's absolute. And then we change our views, and then we hear another headline and we change our views again. So, you know, it's quite overwhelming.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And, you know, we all worry. I worry. We all worry. We worry about our families. And that's human nature. And you know, part of why I wrote this book was really to sort of calm everybody down a little bit, because nothing is going to be so extreme, hopefully, that we hear or that we see. So a perfect example, the Ebola outbreak a few years ago. We all, you know, what was that? Oh, yeah, I remember. Now it's a little bit back in the news. But at the time, everyone was panicked. We didn't know if we can get on an airplane, if we can travel, if we can go to a hospital. We didn't know what to do in hospitals. In hospitals, we had drills with all these hazmat suits as far as what to do when the next Ebola case comes in. Well, you know, it was horrible and it was devastating. Worldwide, there were 20,000 cases of Ebola. There were a handful in this country. There was one death. In that same year, there were 2 million new cases of AIDS. But we weren't talking about AIDS. We were talking about Ebola. 2 million versus 20,000. That year, there were over 30,000 deaths in this country from the flu and a handful from Ebola. But we weren't talking about the flu. We were talking about Ebola. So it really is what draws us in. Zika was another one. Zika is real. It's not something that we should just write off as nothing. Ticks are another concern. There are plenty of concerns out there, but we get so panicked that we forget about the mundane stuff that keeps us alive and keeps us healthy, but we focus on these really exciting headlines that draw us in. So for those of us in the room, there are a few of us in the room who are over 35, just a few. We all can look back and remember what we did to prepare for Y2K, right? So that was a little bit of a while ago. But now think back. What did everyone did something? We all, even if it was something small. whether we took out some more cash, we got some milk for our fridge, we had an extra fun party because we knew nothing was going to happen. But we all, most people, even if you didn't do any actual preparedness, and we live in earthquake country, so we're sort of used to that preparedness notion, a lot of people in this country did something to prepare for Y2K. And who did the most were the tech people. Actually, they really did a lot for Y2K, and we can thank them that we are that the world did not explode as the clocks turned because they didn't know how to change 99 to 00, and so we can thank them that the banks didn't freeze and everything sort of happened the next day. But there was a little bit of disappointment that nothing happened. We were all sort of looking for what's going to happen, and something's going to explode, or some grocery store is not going to open, or the cash registers or something, and really nothing happened. It was a regular year, except that it was one of the highest flu seasons of the year because nobody was getting their flu shot. They were all preparing for Y2K. I know I keep going back to the flu, but it's almost flu season, so get your flu shot when it comes out. So we like to do that. We all like that extreme, that excitement, the mundane. You're not going to see a news article that says 7-year-old didn't get the measles. It's not going to make headlines. It's always going to be something negative or something extreme or something that's going to draw us in. And that's how the media works. That's why it functions. Not too long ago, back in March, there was this great story that an astronaut, an identical twin, was up in space for a year. He was in the space station for a year, his identical twin. Came back, and they obviously tested his blood and to see what was going on, see what sort of changes he had. And 7% of his DNA changed. Isn't that amazing? You can go into space and 7% of your DNA can change. And people were calling. I remember I was in the OR that day, and a friend of mine called me who's not in medicine. He's like, oh, Neen, you've got to talk about this. This is so cool. 7% of your DNA can change when you go into space. Don't you think people are going to want to do that? And they can become different people, and he's not identical twin anymore, and maybe he's better or stronger. Well, you can't change 7% of your DNA. It's not, you'd be a frog if you changed 7% of your DNA. We're all different people. We are 99%+ identical when it comes to our DNA. You can't do that. But some proteins that are expressed by your DNA were changed. But because they took out the word protein expression, because that wouldn't look very exciting on a headline, it went from science to science fiction in a matter of a few words. And this went to mainstream media. This wasn't just, some sort of small buzz on a site. This was all over the news, mainstream media, within a matter of hours until they had to pull back and say, oops, we forgot a few words. You can't change your DNA in space. Sorry about that. So, it's enticing. And again, I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. I didn't know that genetics can do that. And, it's all of us that really get duped all the time. So back to vitamins. We talked about this a little bit before. I find vitamins and supplements very interesting. About 50 to 70% of this country takes vitamins. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. And people over 65, I think it's on the order of 70%, take at least a multivitamin or supplement, if not more. Why do we do this? And do they work? So why do we do this? We do this for our health. We feel like it's going to make us healthier. It makes us feel better. And for the most part, it does. And frankly, I take a supplement. I take a multivitamin, and I take a vitamin D. How's that? So why do we do this? We do this because we think it's going to make us better. But multiple studies looking at, and I'm not talking about the specific supplements, specifically vitamin D, which has its role, or other specific supplements. Folic acid is very important for women who are pregnant or thinking about being pregnant. But just the general multivitamins and some of the other supplements, do they really work? And what do they do? Most of the studies have shown that they do nothing, that they don't make you healthier, they don't make you live longer, they don't reduce the risk of heart disease or cancer, but we still do them. And I say, by all means, keep doing it. If it makes you feel better, then take it, as long as you're not going to be mega dosing or overdosing on vitamins. And there is such a thing as overdosing on certain vitamins. For the most part, they're benign, and part of it is the placebo effect, which is real. The placebo effect is not just mind over matter, or you think it works and so you're sort of tricking yourself. It's actually a real physiologic entity. So if the placebo effect is what it is, then keep doing it. The most common supplement, however, that is taken aside from multivitamins is vitamin C. So we all, I have a cold, I'm going to take an extra vitamin C and it's going to make my cold better. I think I'm getting a cold, or I might get a cold because I'm traveling. I'm going to take that little packet and put it in my juice and I won't get a cold. And lo and behold, I don't get a cold. It must have been the vitamin C. So where does this come from? Why vitamin C of all vitamins? So Linus Pauling, who was not a hoaxer, he was a brilliant scientist. He won the 2 Nobel Prizes, Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1954, Nobel Peace Prize in 1962. And he was also Time Magazine Man of the Year, because they didn't have Women of the Year back in the 60s, of course. So he was an incredible man, and he went to some lecture, just a random lecture in 1965, by a gentleman who swore that the answer to health was vitamin C supplements. The daily recommended allowance for vitamin C is 60 milligrams. This gentleman recommended 18,000 milligrams per day of vitamin C. It's pretty harmless. You can get kidney stones. Other than that, it's literally just in and out of your system. But Linus Pauling fell for it, and he started taking 18,000 milligrams of vitamin C per day. He wrote an international bestseller, like hype, that said that vitamin C would cure the colds, prevent the flu. Vitamin C, the cold and the flu, I think it was called. International bestseller. And despite the fact that he was a Nobel Peace Prize winner, Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, Linus Pauling, when you think of that name, most people think of, oh, the vitamin C guy. And that's what that's all about. He said vitamin C helps. And we still do that. To this day, we take vitamin C when we have the feeling of a cold, or we take it routinely to prevent colds. But there's actually no evidence that, you know, vitamin C certainly has its benefits, but there's no evidence that it's going to treat or prevent or reduce the incidence of a cold. So going back a little bit, I mentioned it a few times and I'll mention it again, the flu shot. So some of us get the flu shot. Not everybody gets the flu shot. Some people obviously have to get the flu shot if we go to work. Some people get it because they've had the flu. Most people who've had the flu from going forward will always get the flu shot. One of the most common things I hear is, I never get the flu shot because the only time I've gotten the flu is when I got the flu shot. So I'm not going to get the flu shot anymore. You can't get the flu from the flu shot. It doesn't give you the flu. You get the flu shot during flu season. It takes about 2 to 3 weeks to work. You may get a little bit of a low-grade fever, and you may have been exposed to the flu before you got your flu shot, and then you may come down with flu symptoms because you're in flu season and you're not protected from the flu, but you're not going to be getting the flu from the flu shot. So the flu shot does save lives. There are tens of thousands of deaths every year in this country. A large part of those deaths are in otherwise healthy people. So I really do recommend getting it because it is protective. It is not 100%. It's not great. People say, oh, it didn't work this year. Well, it's not, you know, it's based on population averages. It's based on the prior season. So we oftentimes don't know what's going to work from 1 year to the next, but it's still better than nothing. Even if it's 30% effective, I'd rather have 30% effective than 0% effective. So it is good to have the flu shot. And a lot of the reason, you know, obviously vaccines have been a big controversy. And one of the issues with vaccine controversy is that we don't see a lot of the vaccine preventable illnesses anymore. And ignorance is really bliss when we don't see these. So I trained in my residency in the early 1990s where epiglottitis, a rare disorder that would affect thousands of children each year, close off their airways. We would have these epiglottitis drills, literally like a fire drill. We would take a pretend patient, usually ages 2 to 5 years old, rush them to the operating room, do a tracheotomy tube. It was horrible. And these kids would die every year, but we would have these epiglottitis drills. We don't see this anymore because there's a vaccine for that. The vaccine came about in the late 1990s, and it's caused by Haemophilus influenza type B, which is nearly eradicated. So we don't see epiglottitis anymore, so we don't worry about it. Another vaccine preventable illness that we've actually started to learn more about is a cancer type related to vaccines, and that's caused by something called HPV, or human papillomavirus, which is a very common virus. About 70 to 80 to 90% of the adult population has this virus, and now there's a vaccine that's being given to young people to try to prevent these cancers in future generations. Primarily, it was known to cause cervical cancer, but now it's being known to cause head and neck cancer, so throat cancers. It's actually now being called the baby boomer cancer because we're seeing it in younger people, non-smokers, non-drinkers. You think of, you know, the smoker with throat cancer and smoking through their laryngectomy, but it's actually seen in healthy young people who have HPV in their tonsils, in their larynx, in their tongue, and it's a hopefully a generation or two from now, this will be a preventable cancer. But we just, you know, you don't necessarily hear about it. It's not going to make headlines. It's a relatively small group of patients. But, you know, I think over the next generation or two, it's going to grow because now only about 20% of the vaccine eligible population for the HPV vaccine is actually getting the vaccine. It's not mandatory. So, you know, it's still considered optional. But, you know, I think it's going to take another generation or two to start seeing some benefits from that vaccine. So another thing that's always been interesting to me, especially on this coast, is complementary and alternative medicine. And, you know, it's sort of a, you know, CAM, we put it together. But, you know, the reality is there's no such thing as alternative medicine. There's medicine that works and medicine that doesn't work. If a medicine is alternative and it works for you, then it works. Then it's medicine. It's not alternative. Complementary, on the other hand, is real and it is good. It has revolutionized the treatment of cancer and chronic illnesses. So complementary medicine is great if it is used in complement to traditional therapy. When it is used alone, and for those of us in medicine, we may have seen patients who've decided not to have standard treatment for aggressive disease and just use complementary medicine with absolutely devastating outcomes because it does not stand alone. It is an excellent adjuvant to therapy for any sort of chronic illness, whether it's chronic pain, chronic diseases, or cancer, but used alone, it can actually be quite dangerous. We see a lot of this in this part of the world because it's beautiful. So you can go to cancer spas. You're not going to be going to cancer spas, with all due respect to anyone from Michigan, in the middle of the winter, but you would go in Southern California to a cancer spa in the middle of the winter. And these are very enticing. They take your money. It's amazing. They don't take insurance. But, you know, it's really, unfortunately, for the most part, a scam because a lot of these centers won't allow you to continue your traditional therapy and they'll make you rely just on their therapy. So why does it work? Some people say that I had complementary alternative medicine and it worked. It cured my X, Y, or Z. And that goes back to the placebo effect. And again, the placebo effect is real. It is a true entity. Probably one of a great example of the placebo effect was actually at UCLA about 50 years ago, 50 or 60 years ago, soon after UCLA came to be. There was a gentleman they had a little bit of privacy then. They called him Mr. Wright. And Mr. Wright had an incurable lymphoma and he was on death's door and they didn't know what to do. So they gave him this medication, this chemotherapy called Crebiozin, which they had no idea. The doctors had no idea, but they thought, you know, we don't have to do any sort of IRB or anything. We'll just give it to him. And we're going to tell him that this is going to fix him. So they gave him this experimental drug. And they told him and him alone that this drug was going to cure his lymphoma. Within weeks, he walked out of the hospital cancer-free. The other patients who got the same drug, they didn't tell that it was going to help. They did not respond to the drug. He responded to the drug. He got home. He read some articles in the newspaper saying that this drug is actually useless. Soon after that, his cancer came back to the hospital. And what would doctors do? Of course, they lied to him again. And they said, we're going to give you a stronger, better version of it. And they gave him that stronger, better version, and it worked. It worked again. And soon afterwards, he died. But it extended his life about 6 months, this fake drug. And people would say, okay, well, again, mind over matter. He thought and he felt better and his immune system changed. Well, what if he were a rat? And there have been rat studies. Look, you know, not that rats don't have brains. They're very and have conscious thoughts. But, you know, there have been some rat studies where they give the rats something to suppress their immune system, something called cyclosporin. They'll suppress their immune system and give them a little bit of a sugar drink. Weeks later, their immune system is down. They take that same group of rats and give them just a sugar drink, and they'll associate that sugar drink with dropping their immune system, and those same rats will drop their immune system just with a sugar drink. So that's an example of, well, is it the placebo? Is it mind over matter? You know, it's very interesting. It's still being studied. It's not really clear how this works, but, you know, it is fascinating. So One of the reasons I wrote this book, obviously, was to open my mind, because I am a natural skeptic when I hear things, but, you know, I have a very narrow field. Some people say, well, why did you write this? You're a pediatric ear, nose, and throat doctor, very specific area. You wrote this book about everything. What do you know? And, you know, I learned a lot writing this book. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, I think it also just goes to show you that even if you're not in medicine or in healthcare or have a medical background or a science background, a lot of this stuff is available and readable and interesting. And I think that people in general don't, you know, whether you're reading something about politics and you don't know anything about politics, well, learn a little bit. I think people don't give themselves enough credit to be skeptical about what they read. Nothing is going to be as good or as bad as you think. If something sounds too good to be true or too bad to be true, it probably is too good to be true or too bad to be true. There is no miracle pill. There is no miracle diet. There is no best diet. There is no best exercise. One of the last chapters of the book is anti-aging. People go right to that. They say, that's, you know, where's the answer there? And I won't tell you, but, you know, the reality is, you know, there is no magic answer to any of this. I think so much of it is common sense, but we are lured by so much that we hear and that we see and that we read that we forget what our common sense is. We'll worry about Y2K, but we won't put our seatbelt on when we're going to the grocery store to stock up on water. So I hope you enjoyed this. I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
So we're listening to Nina Shapiro talk about her book, Hype, and now we're open for audience questions.
A lot of grocery stores have dispensers with the wipes, the antibacterial wipes.
Yes.
And I watch people, and they're very careful to wipe down the handle, well, their own hands first.
Okay. Yeah.
And then wipe, you know, and this becomes a habit for people. What's that about? I mean, I don't do it.
But. No, yeah. I shop online. No, just kidding. So, you know, this whole notion of, you know, there's been a lot that talked about the antibacterial nation and you know, that, you know, we're spraying our children with all of these antibacterial gels before they go outside to play in the dirt, which is really what they should be doing. You know, certainly some viruses do live on surfaces, cold viruses, for instance, flu viruses. There was a hepatitis outbreak recently in LA, and that can live for over 24 hours on surfaces. But you can't wipe down your world. So, you know, I think that's a little bit extreme. I think that, you know, if you're sick, you're probably going to get somebody else sick. If somebody was sick and touched that grocery cart, you may catch what they had. But then you're touching all of the items in the store, too. They can't spray down the store. So, you know, I think it's a drop in a very big ocean that really doesn't make a difference.
Yes, doctor, I had just a quick question. I'm a diabetic. And along with my metformin, I take cinnamon and chromium percolinate, which in a lot of the health books said that helped to regulate your blood sugar.
Hmm.
Now, I know the metformin does because that's, you know, I think that's been proven from over many years. But what do you think about taking health supplements that have had a long history? Like cinnamon has been used in India for many, many years to treat diabetes before they had insulin and that sort of thing. What do you think about that? Those types of supplements?
You know, I think it's interesting. I think a lot of those have a lot of benefit, especially if you're using it in concert with something like metformin. For instance, nausea, for those of us who may have had nausea during pregnancy, you know, ginger is thought to help with that. You know, that's not something that, you know, you're going to necessarily get in a pill, although you can, but it's not sort of a standard, you know, for nausea, take ginger, but it certainly can help. And so I think if there's something that's helping regulate, whether it's the metformin alone or in addition to these supplements, I think, you know, it's certainly fine.
Hi, Dr. Shapiro, is Dr. Guthrie's lectin theory true or hype? You know, Dr.
I do know. Yes, he's right up the road. Yeah, his book's doing very well. You know, I think that's interesting. You know, his book is The Plant Paradox. I think that's what you're referring to. And the notion is that some lectin, which is a content in some what we would think of as very healthy vegetables, such as tomatoes, I think that's the big one on the cover, can cause obesity and other sorts of problems. I don't really buy into that, frankly. You know, hype may be a strong word, but it certainly would be a good word.
Dr. Shapiro, so I'm a physical therapist, and I think one of the trickiest things when people are trying to search the internet or search for information is the fact that there are some things that are just really tough to be able to do a randomized, controlled, double-blind sure. study with,
right.
okay? And in my world, movement is medicine for not only musculoskeletal issues, but it we all know mind-body is all connected, right? So I think that's where it gets very tricky mm-hmm. for some fields of healthcare right. and how things are reimbursed. Because, you know, if I'm treating somebody for a low back, I'm looking at their foot because what hits the ground first and how that's going to affect everything up the chain. But the healthcare and the insurance system is rewarding those who, oh, you need to come in for an evaluation for your back. Oh, you can't treat the foot because you don't have a mm-hmm. prescription for that.
Yeah.
Any thoughts and experiences that you've had kind of with that in mind with our disease management system versus really a health prevention model?
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that we have to think that way, that everything is so cut and dry. And for those of us in healthcare, we know, you know, we spend most of our days checking boxes, which is insane. You know, and it is unfortunate because you can't study a lot of these things. You know, even something a little more cut and dry, for instance, colonoscopy. You know, which is a very sort of, you know, screening study. It's been studied for many years. But how are you going to study the efficacy? We're going to take this group of 50-year-olds and not have them have colonoscopies. You can have colonoscopies. It's okay. We're just a study. And then we're going to have these 50-year-olds have colonoscopies and see who dies from colon cancer. So a lot of things are hard to study, you know, certainly prospectively. And when it comes to things that are helpful, whether, you know, physical therapy is a perfect example. Speech therapy, you know, I work with a lot of speech therapists, and they get denied all the time because that kid sounds fine. Well, no, they don't. You know, it's really hard sometimes to, you know, when it's qualitative and you can't necessarily put a number on it, to put, you know, when it comes to healthcare and insurance, certainly it becomes very tricky.
Hi. You know, you attributed a lot of successes to certain, you know, non-medical treatments to the placebo effect. But in fact, you know, there are, which is becoming even more increasingly noticed with even cancer treatment, that individual people respond physically to medications or supplements differently. Mm-hmm. So could you address that whole issue of how you dismiss things as placebo rather than, you know, possibly this person had a different response mm-hmm. to whatever it was that you were treating.
Right. I mean, it's a good point. I think certainly on an individual basis, there will be people who have excellent response to something that's not necessarily by the book, by the guidelines, completely different, and vice versa. Some, you know, unfortunately, there'll be individuals who have a horrible outcome, whether it's a negative response, no response, or a complication from something where other people wouldn't. So, you know, I don't want to say that all of, you know, anything that's not necessarily completely conventional, it must be placebo, that it has to be fake. That's I don't mean to say that, but, you know, a lot of the things that we do that we think are good for us that are more inert, I would say, not necessarily that it's not a conventional treatment, but that has a non-effect. For instance, taking a vitamin C supplement when you have a cold, it's not going to hurt you. It's not going to necessarily prevent the cold. But, you know, certainly for things that are not necessarily by the book, if individually it helps, you know, for instance, headaches are a common problem in this population. And it doesn't mean that you necessarily need to cure your headaches by taking a pill. There are a lot of other ways for headache prevention and headache treatment that doesn't necessarily come in a pill bottle or you know, by, you know, a prescription by your doctor. There may be other methods that can prevent or treat headaches. So, you know, there is certainly individual situations for anything.
Thoughts on the latest fad, the keto diet, and long-term effects.
So the question is about the keto diet, which is, you know, the notion of very, very, very high protein, very low carb diet, and putting yourself into something called ketosis, which we learned about in medical school as a pathologic entity. But the idea is if you put yourself in ketosis, that your body will start metabolizing differently, your liver will work differently, and you will burn calories almost internally. So, you know, it's a diet. So people, you know, it's for weight loss. And also, you know, actually the ketogenic diet initially was used medicinally for children with seizure disorders before medications for seizure disorders came to be. And you know, a lot of those kids are still on ketogenic diets to prevent seizures. So it is a real diet. You know, it's a short term, you know, it tends to be short term. It's really hard to stay on the ketogenic diet. Used to be called Atkins, was very similar to a ketogenic diet. For those of us who remember Atkins, the same idea, very high protein, very low carb, low sugar or no sugar. But, you know, you're substituting, and this is why people like it, is bacon is on the ketogenic diet. And anything that, you know, steak and eggs and all this stuff, which has, you know, very high fat, very high cholesterol. And so you may lose, and you will lose a lot of weight if you go on these very high protein, low carb diets. Carbohydrates are basically like a sponge, and they keep water, you know, they retain water. So you will gain weight if you eat more carbohydrates. But, but it's not good for your heart to have this as a long term. I think it's not a good diet long term. It's fine. You know, people want to lose 5-10 pounds quickly. Fine, by all means. But, you know, it's not a benign diet. So I don't really recommend it.
Can you comment on the on a follow up to the cell phone question? Where is it going? How should it be handled? Mm-hmm. When will it, or is it handled?
Yeah, you know, it's still being studied, and it's really hard to study this because think about how to create, you know, a perfect double-blinded, placebo-controlled, randomized, prospective cohort. Okay, all of you put your cell phone on your ear and talk for 6 hours a day, and I'll see you for your MRI. And then all of you, I'm going to give you a speaker, and you don't have to. So it's really hard to study. Some of the studies have shown that there was a slight increase in extreme high use of cell phone for more than 8 hours a day for certain types of brain tumors. Again, it was such a small number. The majority of the studies, and again, it's really hard to look at this, show that there was no association between cell phone use and increase in brain tumors. They're still looking at it because it's so hard to study over a long period of time. Right. Yeah. So PubMed, you know, their studies are always being published. You know, thousands of studies per day on a given topic are coming out on PubMed, Google Scholar or PubMed to see what is the, you know, and again, when you read these studies, all you need to look at is the number of subjects that were included. And if it's six, you probably don't need to read any further. You know, if it's 60,000, you know, over a 2 to 3 to 5 year period, you know, that's a little more interesting. And was it humans that they studied? You know, that's the other thing. It's really hard to do human subject studies on things like this. Yes.
Yes, this is an ENT thing.
Oh, good. We have some.
I met many decades in San Francisco, and I moved to Rossmo with all this pollen running around. In just a few months, I had swollen eyes, just terrible. Got some antibiotics, cured it. 2 weeks later, I had pneumonia. And more antibiotics. I said, enough of this. I got some of the special salts and pumped them up my nose, mm-hmm. cleared out my sinuses, and had just minor problems ever since.
Best thing. Nasal saline, best thing invented, over the counter, and it prevents. We use it for kids, we use it for infants, we use it for adults. It's, you know, nasal hygiene. People underestimate the value of nasal hygiene. Yeah. Just keeping it clear. You don't need a medication necessarily. It's treatment and prevention. So good. Glad you're better.
I found out that I'm incredibly sensitive to sleep, and this is many years ago that I actually really studied it. I tracked it. I found out that if I have to go to bed, if I go to bed, lights out at 10:30, I am good to go. But I hit 11 o'clock and it starts getting. So it just seems like this is like one of the most important health whatever you want to call it, the cure mm-hmm. for a lot of things, yeah. and we never talk about it, and it just seems so incredibly important. Comments?
So I tried to write a book a few years ago called Good Night, Sleep Tight. Wasn't picked up. So, yeah, no, I think it's very, you know, and I've looked at this a lot in pediatrics, actually. You know, pediatric sleep is really sort of understudied until more recent, you know, in the recent decade or so. Sleep is very important. You know, it's very important for kids, very important for adults, very important for teenagers. And it is sort of underlooked at. And you know, we know the blue lights that we all look at. We all check our phones before we go to sleep, or we have our phone at our bedside, or the buzzes are going off. We'll just check. And, you know, the sleep disruption nowadays is much more than it was, you know, even a few years ago. Sleep is very important. And, you know, some people are more sensitive. And it is true. Some people need 6 hours of sleep. Some people need 9 hours of sleep, and it doesn't make you a lesser person if you just probably won't make you a surgeon if you need 9 hours of sleep. Although I could probably use 9 hours of sleep, but you know it's you know that's very different, and people are much more sensitive to time change. For instance, you know some people have trouble with east-west travel, whether it's just across the country or going you know as far you know to Europe where it's a 9-hour time change. Some people just you know it really turns their world upside down. Some people can sleep anywhere. You know, when we were residents, we would want to get the cases where we would hold the retractors a certain way so we can nap during surgeries. I did, at least. So, you know, sleep is sort of under talked about, but it is very important, absolutely. And the quality of sleep. It's not just the number of hours, but it's what's going on. Do you have sleep apnea? Sleep apnea is very common in kids and adults. And, you know, do you have, you know, restless sleep or, you know, poor REM sleep? So, you know, it's very important.
Here's our last question.
Okay. I have a question about stem cell research. With new medical innovations and genetic manipulation, you can look to the future for some amazing potential cures. But what was exposed last week in the Chronicle was an enormous operation in Southern California and around the country of stem cell implantation, cosmetically, taking from fat cells in people's body and infusing it into other parts of their body, injecting it. And without a lot of promise for cures, physicians were applying this without license that it was going to cure anything. So apparently there's a nationwide network of people injecting stem cells from the bodies of the mm-hmm. patients. Do you have any comments about this kind of charlatanism, I guess?
Well, I mean,
say.
It sounds like it's a shady operation, you know, and as with anything, was this for cosmetic purposes, like face or cosmetics or for? Yeah, I mean, certainly it sounds like a shady operation. I think that, you know, unfortunately that happens with anything, you know, with any new innovation or even old innovations. You know, when things become legalized or an innovation becomes, people want to get ahead of it and they try to cut corners and, you know, they obviously cause some significant damage.
So I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. We thank Dr. Nina Shapiro for her comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than 115 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you. Can I get back to you? Thank you. Thank you. It was fun.